Merci beaucoup. Je vais essayer de parler lentement et distinctement. And that is the extent of my French. Thank you very much, Professor Supriyo, for inviting me for this conference. And I'll just take a minute also to thank the interpreters sitting up there. You are the best interpreters I've come across so far. And I think one of your voices is very close to my own. Thank you. Yesterday evening, I'll be talking about a very specific scenario in India. So yesterday evening, I was thinking that I need to contextualize my talk in on the basis of the talks that were given yesterday. And then I was really attracted by Pierre Mousseau's documentation of how the idea of solidarity evolved over time from a sociological point of view. And I thought it's very interesting to note how solidarity evolved in the 19th century and then became an ideology in the post-World War period and then kind of declined. And then I was extremely attracted by André Pichot's presentation yesterday. I thought, what if I try to explain this from the perspective of the genetic theory? So would our genes in the 19th century act proactively in order to preserve the genetic trait or close genetic traits? And then would our genes behave differently after World War II in order to make it an ideology? And then in the neoliberal era, would our genes act in a manner that solidarity declined because of the change in genetic traits? I thought, it's a fascinating idea. I need more time to think and contextualize my talk on the basis of genetic theory and the sociological evolution of the idea of solidarity. And since I'm in France, I thought it's better for me if I contextualize my talk on the backdrop of liberty, equality, and fraternity, which is provided in Indian Constitution. So the Indian Constitution aims to offer liberty, equality, and fraternity, social justice to its citizens, and also under certain circumstances to non-citizens. Interestingly, Indian Constitution is a socialist constitution. And the idea of socialism in Indian Constitution runs through two chapters in the Constitution, which provides fundamental rights and directive principles of state policy. So these are the two chapters. While fundamental rights are enforceable in the court of law, directive principles of state policy are not enforceable, and it is subject to the economic capacity of the state. So a citizen or an individual can go to the court if the fundamental rights are infringed, but a citizen cannot have any claim against the state if the directive principles of state policy are not enforced by the state. Labor jurisprudence, labor laws have constitutional basis in India. The fundamental rights chapter talks about rights such as right to association, right against forced labor, right against child labor, right to freedom of speech and expression. Directive principles of state policy, on the other hand, talks about equal pay for equal work, workers' participation in management, maternity benefit, right to work, and right to livelihood. So all these rights are socioeconomic rights which are not enforceable. Unless the state comes up with a legislation that enforces these constitutional rights and realizes it for the population. And in my talk, I'm going to talk about one such instance where the state came up with a legislation in order to realize two social political rights, socioeconomic rights, right to work and right to livelihood. And I will discuss it in the context of informal workers. I just want to take a minute here in order to very briefly explain who are informal workers. Even though the idea is very fuzzy, one needs to work with it. And informal workers as a very basic understanding, are workers who are generally excluded from documentation and who are excluded from the protective coverage of different statutes, different laws. So they are informal workers. And the number of informal workers in India are more than 90%. That includes agricultural workers who are excluded from labor legislations. And I just gathered a data from the ILO report called Men and Women in the Informal Economy, 2002. It's 62% in Mexico, 34% in South Africa, 48% in North Africa, which is North Africa is excluding agriculture. It's not only a phenomenon in Global South, it's also a phenomenon in Europe and to some extent in the United States. Atypical work, such as self-employment, part-time work, temporary work, undocumented work, it is about 30% in 15 European countries and about 25% in the United States. That was the ILO in 2002. So one could imagine what's the extent of exclusion of informal workers in the context of India. Since I'm not going to tell you a detective story, let me give you the thesis of my talk. So here is what I'm going to argue in my talk. I'm going to argue that with respect to informal workers, we need to think in solidarity in different terms than we are accustomed to thinking about solidarity in the case of workers. So instead of thinking about solidarity in the context of trade unions, we need to adopt an idea of solidarity that includes several other entities and individuals, larger social partnership and networks. And I will show you with two instances, one in the context of the state-provided legal right, and other in the context of private initiatives, how this kind of solidarity, which need not be a trade union, works in order to enhance the working lives of informal workers in order to improve their condition. That's the thesis of the talk, and in the first section, I'm going to talk about the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act that was enacted by the Indian Parliament in 2005 that guarantees employment to rural workers. And in the second section, I'll talk about urban workers who are excluded from the purview of this legislation. I'll spend some time to explain the structure of the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, or in short, NREGA, or the 2005 Act. So the law it gives legal right to informal workers in rural areas. And since in India, there is hardly any unemployment benefit or social security mechanism, everyone has to do some kind of work. And since 90% of the people are doing informal work, and the majority of whom are in the agricultural sector, a huge significant number of informal workers are based in rural areas, and this law seeks to provide them guaranteed employment for 100 days in 1 year. The employment given is demand-driven. Since it's a legal right, as and when the citizens make a demand on the state or the government, the state is bound, obligated to provide that right to employment to these workers. The law talks about one worker per household. So for each family, one worker can be part of this employment guarantee. The law very interestingly talks about unemployment guarantee or unemployment allowance. So if, after making a demand, if the state or the government fails to employ that person, the government is duty-bound, mandated under this legislation, to provide unemployment benefit to such worker who has made a demand on the state to receive employment, but unable to get that because of a failure on the part of the state. rural administrative bodies are mandated to execute the law. It's the village level bodies. The law also mandates social audit to be undertaken by the rural communities. And social audit means monitoring and analyzing the implementation of this employment guarantee legislation, which necessarily needs to involve rural communities along with other organizations and local self-government, which in India is known as panchayats. The law prioritizes women. It says 1/3 of the workers employed under the NREGA 2005 need to be women workers. And by doing that, the law, in a sense, addresses gender justice. And it also promotes household incomes, because if women could be employed in a government scheme very close to their houses in rural areas, then the men are free to go outside the village in order to get much more beneficial, in order to get employed in much more beneficial endeavors. And if women could earn, they have more say in the household. That's one more thing before I move on to the genesis of the act. Is the law talks about employment in infrastructural development, in rural infrastructural development, such as irrigation, construction of roads, construction of canals, and people argue, scholars argue, that these infrastructural development would enhance, on one hand, agricultural productivity in the rural areas, and on the other hand, will stop out-migration from rural areas to urban areas. This piece of legislation, which is a realization of the constitutional socioeconomic rights, was achieved through solidaristic action. And I'm just going to mention who were the entities or who were the institutions that were behind the enactment of this legislation. Trade unions were there, women's organizations were there, progressive politicians, bureaucrats, social activists. They constituted an umbrella organization, People's Action for Employment Guarantee, which is constitutive of individuals, organizations, academia, trade unions, women organizations, and political parties. Now, this was a lobbying body that lobbied with the government and political parties in order to realize the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act of 2005. Interestingly, along with these organizations, in India, there is a body called National Advisory Council, which is kind of another government. If you are aware of the Indian political scenario, there are two major political parties. One is left to center and one is right. So the left to center political party is headed by an Italian born married to an Indian individual. And there was hue and cry when she was on the verge of becoming prime minister. So therefore, she instituted an Indian prime minister, Indian-born, Indian-brought-up prime minister. But then there was another organization constituted body, this National Advisory Council, which she headed. So this National Advisory Council is to advise the government of India, but it's not the government of India. And this National Advisory Council also had social activists, individuals, and all these organizations that I just mentioned. And they vehemently argued for an employment guarantee scheme, and that was one of the election promises made by this party. And the law was enacted in 2005. That was the time when Indian left parties were supporting this government. So the communist, the four or five communist and left parties were supporting the government from outside, and that coalition enacted this legislation. And a precursor to this legislation was the Indian state of Maharashtra, where after a drought, there was scheme, rural employment guarantee schemes that developed infrastructure. But it was only a scheme, it was not legal right. So it was dependent on the economic capacity of the state government of Maharashtra. So that scheme over the years took the shape of this National Rural Employment Guarantee Law. I mentioned this, and I just flag it here. I mentioned this background mechanism because I'll be getting back to the enactment of the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act in order to draw your attention towards the different constituents that were behind this, well, this social welfare legislation. So I wanted to identify the solidarity or the act of solidarity or the networking that goes behind the state action, which I'll get back to after my discussion of the private legislation, the private initiatives. Now, there are problems with the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, and I'll quickly point those out. Employment is only provided to informal workers in rural areas. So workers in urban areas are excluded from the scope of the legislation. Employment is guaranteed only for 3.5 months in 1 year. So for the rest of the time, there is no employment guarantee. So people, again, have to go back to their own informal diverse categories of work. Another problem is the law says only one adult member from each household could get this legal right. They're entitled to this legal right. Now, if you're familiar with the Indian household system, there are many households which are joint families, which means there are multiple male workers. There are several women and several children in one family. So what happens is priority is always given to men if they do not have work. That makes it difficult for women to get work, because the legislation is per household, one worker. On the other hand, it also can give rise to animosity within the family as to who will get the job, whether it be the eldest brother or the youngest one or the middle one in case of a joint family. One more thing that is very central to all schemes, all laws, everything Indian is corruption. And I just checked today morning the Transparency International Report 2011. India is ranked 94th amongst 176 nations in the corruption index. And if you are keeping records, the last government has been the most corrupt government in a long, long time. There are inadequacy also in the planning of what kind of rural development or assets development could be undertaken. And I can tell you from my personal experience, I'm from a rural area, and I see people are only digging holes wherever there is government land, because they need to provide employment, and employment is being provided just to dig holes, and nothing is done. When the rainy season comes, the holes are again shut down, and for the next employment guarantee, the same holes are being digged again. Even though I'm not citing this as an authoritative source, but there has been study conducted by scholars that is very related to this experience, because there is no planning that goes behind rural infrastructural development, and that makes it very difficult that this law could be productively employed. Otherwise, if assets development is not happening, then it's like doling out money to the poor, which is not very productive in the overall sense of the law. There are irregularities in implementation of the law, irregularities in payment of wages, irregularities in issuing job cards to rural household, lack of work site facilities such as creche. If women, one-third women workers are mandated under the law, you need to also have creche in the workplace, because they cannot possibly leave their children back home in order to undertake their work. Avoidance of mandatory community participation, involvement of harmful vested interest, which goes back to corruption. More importantly, the government is trying to sabotage the act. India has no dearth of labor laws. There are more than 100 labor laws. But very interestingly, these more than 100 labor laws applies to less than 9% of workers in India, total workers in India. One of these labor laws are the Minimum Wage Act, minimum wage law. The government argued pretty recently that the Minimum Wage Act is not applicable for National Rural Employment Guarantee legislation because it's a welfare provision and minimum wage cannot apply to the law, because one provision in the law, one section in the law says, notwithstanding anything contained in any other law, this law will prevail over all other legislation. And the government is interpreting that as this law, Rural Employment Guarantee Law, will override the Minimum Wages Act. And that has been vehemently protested by all these entities that I mentioned earlier, individuals, academics, trade unions, women's organizations, and a bunch of other non-government organizations. They filed a case against the government, and in two Indian high courts, the case was decided against the government. So it was held that nothing overrides the Minimum Wages Act. So government has to provide minimum wages to all these workers who are employed under the Employment Guarantee Act. However, the government is not ashamed as of now. The government has appealed to the Supreme Court, the Indian Supreme Court, in order to reverse the judgment of the Karnataka High Court that says that minimum wages should be guaranteed. Interestingly, however, the Supreme Court did not want to stay the judgment of the Karnataka High Court, which was prima facie sought by the government. So Supreme Court did not give a stay on the Karnataka High Court judgment. As of now, minimum wages needs to be paid, but the court is still in the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is yet to decide the case. Other problems, manual work sometimes excludes women. With respect to manual unskilled work, in rural areas, there are certain underlying assumptions that goes behind this legislation. The underlying assumptions are people are physically fit, they have good nutrition, they're healthy, and they all can undertake manual work. But the rest of the things are not true. So what I'm arguing here is only provision for legal right does not really help informal workers in these rural areas. Because the background assumptions of overall human development of workers does not really work. So therefore, I'm arguing here, we need to have solidarity in the sense network of plethora of organizations in order to make those assumptions true, in order to promote human development of workers so that they can realize the legal right provided under the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act. However, so far, organizations or networks in rural areas haven't been able to undertake much initiative in this respect. However, there are other undertakings. In some rural areas, yes, it's being done, but not a lot. However, as I'll show over the course of my next 7 minutes, that organizations and networks in urban areas are doing a much better job in order to promote overall human development of informal workers who are based in urban areas. Is it everything is bad about this employment guarantee law? Well, perhaps not. Scholars also identify some advantages or some benefits of the Rural Employment Guarantee Act. They argue that NREGA, or the 2005 Act, narrowed the gap between demand and supply of employment. It provides livelihood support. It is very helpful during emergencies. It promotes women's participation. Assets development is sometimes helpful for agricultural development. It's possible to stop rural outmigration. Possible to enhance purchasing power of the poor. And more importantly, it offers a hope of entitlement. That's like two major economists in India arguing that it offers a hope of entitlement that is in the realm of possibility. Since you have a legal right, it's very much possible to realize employment guarantee. So I flagged that there was immense amount of role played by multiple organizations and individuals behind the enactment of this law. Now, I'm briefly going to talk about how implementation is also influenced by organizations and solidaristic action of organizations and individuals. The law provides for social audit, which is monitoring and looking after the transparency of the law, its implementation. The social audit is being conducted by a bunch of organizations, prominent NGOs, trade unions, and other noted civil society activists. There is also a national consortium of civil society organizations that is constitutive of 51 organizations, which has a reach at 45 districts and spread along 10 states in India, who are looking after social audits or implementation of this legislation. And they are working very closely with local grassroots organizations, the panchayats. So, quickly flagging, solidaristic action is necessary even for state-mandated welfare laws that promotes informal workers' livelihoods and their right to work at two stages, enactment and implementation. However, the problem with the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act is it's only available in rural areas. What happens with urban areas? They're outside the scope of the constitutional guarantees. So workers have come together in urban areas under different or kinds of organizations. Now, these organizations are, how much more time is it? Okay, these organizations are trade unions registered under the Indian Trade Unions Act of 1926, cooperative societies registered under the 1912 law, registered society registered under the Societies Registration Act 1860, charitable and religious trust. Now these organizations, which legally are varied, provides two kinds of services to workers. On one hand, they're promoting workers' overall human development by providing education, insurance, healthcare, legal consultation, and all those things. And on the other hand, they're lobbying with the government in order to realize workers' rights, and they are networking even with international organizations. So, the moral of the story, this is the punchline, and this is the time when you should be paying attention. Now, the conclusion. In conclusion, I'm arguing that informal workers, whether they realize their promotion of human development from the state or from organizations, need to be broad-based socially. And here I'm following Robert Putnam's idea of bonding and bridging. While specific categories of informal workers, for example, rickshaw pullers, for example, waste pickers who recycle waste, for example, street vendors who sell things by the side of the street, while they bond amongst themselves because they do the same work, they share the same life experiences, but they also need to bridge with other organizations, individuals, in order to enhance their bargaining power. This is because they're not always bargaining with the employer. They're more often than not are bargaining with the state. Self-employed street vendors wouldn't have an employer. Waste pickers who are working in the waste recycling industry wouldn't have an employer. So they need to directly talk to the state. And here I'm also arguing that it need not be conflictual. It has to be collaborative with the help of larger coalition these workers need to act. So this broad-based social solidaristic attempt is useful, and as the evidence shows, is working in the context of informal workers in India. And I also want to, just one last comment, that I'm arguing these solidaristic organizations on wider social network-based organizations need not think about larger, bigger goals. They have to address immediate concerns as their strategy. I'll just stop there, and if there are questions, I could revert back to some of these aspects with you. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup. Alors, en quelques mots, pour résumer l'intervention du professeur Roos, il a commencé par rappeler l'existence en Inde d'une constitution d'inspiration socialiste, non pas communiste, mais socialiste, donc où la notion d'État social a été d'emblée extrêmement importante. Et cette constitution contient deux chapitres sur les droits fondamentaux et distingue les droits proprement dits qui sont justiciables, comme par exemple le droit syndical, et d'autres qui sont des directives politiques adressées aux autorités politiques qui ne sont pas directement justiciables, selon une distinction qui est bien connue de vous. Alors ensuite, l'essentiel de son propos consistait à s'interroger sur la mise en œuvre de ces droits fondamentaux pour ce qu'on appelle le travail informel, qui représente en Inde plus de 90% de la population qui travaille. Et Monsieur Routh a donné quelques comparaisons. Ces proportions sont comparables à celles qu'on peut voir en Afrique, notamment en Afrique du Sud, en Amérique du Sud. Peut-être on en parlera aussi avec le professeur Fragal cet après-midi. Et cette prédominance massive des travailleurs informels oblige à penser la solidarité selon d'autres voies que celles qui peuvent être développées lorsque l'on se réfère au paradigme de l'emploi salarié. Si j'ose dire, il faut donc penser au-delà de l'emploi. Alors, il a donné deux exemples complémentés, enfin, de réponse à cette mise en œuvre des droits fondamentaux. Alors, le premier est une loi qui est très célèbre, dont les spécialistes ont pas mal parlé, parce que c'était une initiative originale. D'ailleurs, je pense qu'il y aurait des comparaisons à faire avec ce qui nous sera dit cet après-midi sur les initiatives du président Lula dans le cas brésilien. Il s'agit donc, si je traduis, d'une loi de garantie d'emploi rural à l'échelon national, donc NREGA, qui date de 2005. Et cette loi garantit au moins 100 jours de travail payés par an à une personne par famille, tout dans l'ensemble du territoire de l'Inde. La mise en œuvre de cette loi implique les collectivités territoriales et les administrations d'État, enfin les structures villageoises. Et l'idée qui est à la base de cette loi est que ce travail doit servir à développer des infrastructures et à aider le développement économique par des équipements collectifs qui seraient susceptibles de freiner l'exode rural. Donc il y a l'idée dans la construction de cette loi de nouer la protection des faibles, des garanties de revenus et des stratégies vertueuses de développement. Il a rappelé ensuite les origines politiques de l'adoption de cette loi, le rôle que joue, enfin pour ceux qui connaissent l'Inde, c'est des choses connues, Madame Sonia Gandhi, qui est dans l'ombre du pouvoir, c'est un exemple d'un pouvoir féminin qui se trouve derrière le Premier ministre. Et cette initiative a été prise à partir d'expériences concrètes menées, c'est dans le Maharashtra, je crois, suite à des inondations où un des États de la Fédération indienne avait pris une initiative de ce genre, mais la loi vise donc à donner une base légale et à généraliser ce dispositif. Alors, M. Rousse a fait ensuite un inventaire des faiblesses du dispositif à la lumière de sa mise en œuvre. La première sur laquelle il est revenu ensuite, c'est qu'elle exclut les travailleurs urbains. D'autre part, c'est le caractère modique et insuffisant de la garantie qu'elle donne, puisqu'elle est limitée en fait à 3 mois et demi de travail. D'autre part, cela concerne une personne par famille, bon, d'où la question de savoir qui ça va être, d'où des possibilités de conflits familiaux, le fait qu'il y a des discriminations à raison du sexe, puisque ces tâches sont souvent des tâches physiquement exigeantes et que ce sont plutôt les hommes donc, qui vont les accomplir, et que cela peut conforter l'exclusion ou la marginalisation des femmes. Il a mentionné également une corruption, alors je ne sais pas si elle est à grande échelle en Inde, mais enfin, c'est devenu un des lieux d'exercice de la corruption, puisqu'il y a de l'argent qui circule entre les autorités centrales et les villages, donc il y a des gens qui se servent au passage. Il a aussi pointé l'absence de plans cohérents de développement qui donneraient du sens au travail qu'on demande à accomplir, citant des exemples qui évoquaient le sapeur camembert. Donc il s'agit de creuser des trous, puis de les reboucher, et puis de les recreuser, Mais ce sont des choses auxquelles les universitaires français sont habitués lorsqu'ils ont à réformer les structures administratives de l'université. La vision théorique qui avait été développée, les résultats ne sont pas toujours au rendez-vous. Il a enfin, sur ce point, fait état d'un procès qui, si j'ai bien compris, est encore pendant devant la Cour suprême, puisque les dispositions du droit du travail proprement dit, donc qui concernent moins de 10% de la population, comme je l'ai dit tout à l'heure, prévoient un salaire minimum, et la question a été soulevée de savoir si ce salaire minimum était ou non applicable aux travailleurs ruraux enrôlés dans ce programme. Et pour conclure, il a dit que ce qui manquait en réalité à une mise en œuvre efficace de cette loi, ce sont des organisations fiables, proches du terrain et qui seraient susceptibles de la mettre en œuvre. Alors cela a été une merveilleuse transition parce que, Sopria, vous maîtrisez à merveille le plan en deux parties auquel sont habitués les professeurs de droit français, je vous félicite. Donc la deuxième partie qui concernait le travail urbain, et donc le travail informel urbain. Alors tous ceux d'entre vous qui sont allés en Inde savent cette activité grouillante, spécialement à Calcutta, qui occupe l'immense majorité de la population, en dehors donc du cadre juridique du droit du travail. Et sur ce point où malheureusement il a dû être plus bref en raison du temps, ce qu'il a souligné, c'est qu'en l'absence en fait d'une véritable politique publique, on a le développement d'organisations spontanées, d'associations qui visent à procurer à ces travailleurs les droits minimaux en matière sociale. Et c'est par le développement d'associations hétérogènes, très diverses dans leur forme, dont je serais tenté, mais ça serait un raccourci sans doute audacieux de dire que ça me fait penser à ce qui a pu être dit sur le mutualisme hier par M. Laborde, que c'est cette idée de solidarité volontaire qui permette deux choses. D'une part, d'assurer de mutualité face au risque et donc une protection sur la maladie, une aide pour l'éducation et toute une sorte de services sociaux qui ne sont donc pas limités simplement au catalogue des risques auxquels nous sommes habitués en matière de sécurité sociale. Et ces mêmes organisations sont aussi des organisations d'action collective. Donc la solidarité dans ces associations s'entend sous ces deux sens de protection solidaire et de capacité d'action vis-à-vis des pouvoirs publics à tous les niveaux d'ailleurs. Et alors je sais que l'actualité indienne contient de nombreux exemples d'une capacité très impressionnante de mobilisation des travailleurs, alors qui peut se faire sur une base d'identité de métier, parce que c'est d'abord les gens, ceux qui sont occupés avec une pique à ramasser les papiers ou les conducteurs de rickshaw, etc. Mais il y a aussi des modalités d'association qui permettent à ces différents groupes de se regrouper entre eux.